from the Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. According to the ancient Greeks, Prometheus gave man fire, for which he paid a dear price. In much the same way, it might be said that J. Robert Oppenheimer gave man the atomic bomb, with similar results. Thus the title our guest this week chose for their new book, American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer. They are Kai Bird and Martin Sherwin, and Talking History's John Herron will be speaking to them in just a moment. Following that, Fiona Beatty will offer us another of her sites of the week, this one on the history of atomic power. And Stephen Usden, with news of suicide bombers and terrorists all around us, will wrap it up with a commentary on what motivates fanatic ideologues. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at some recent articles in the news you may have missed. The evolution of the U.S. intelligence capabilities from Pearl Harbor to the establishment of the National Security Agency in 1952 is the subject of a newly declassified NSA document. The 129-page internal history, originally produced in 1990, was published several months ago in hard copy by the NSA Center for Cryptologic History, but it's now available online at the National Security Agency website, www.nsa.gov. The National Park Service has launched a 2-year study of sites around the nation where work was done on the Manhattan Project, the top-secret effort to produce the first atomic bomb, about which we'll be hearing in a moment. The government will determine whether these sites should be included in the national park system. And on the subject of our interview this week, another biographer of J. Robert Oppenheimer, Patricia McMillan, has published another book on the controversial figure, focusing on what she sees as a campaign to discredit Oppenheimer. McMillan, an historian at Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies, argues that the effort had the strong support of both President Dwight Eisenhower and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Less than a year after the United States exploded the two atomic bombs in Japan, she writes, the federal government established agencies to oversee the future of atomic weaponry. Oppenheimer was appointed chair of one of those bodies, the General Advisory Committee of the Atomic Energy Commission, which was the more respected and influential of the two. But by the end of 1954, Oppenheimer would be denied further input into U.S. nuclear policy. His security clearance would be revoked, and his very patriotism called into question. McMillan argues that the move was purely punitive and personal, orchestrated by AEC Chairman Louis Strauss and supported by Edward Teller, a former Manhattan Project colleague. But more on this with our guests this week, Kai Bird and Martin Sherwin, when we return. This is Talking History.
The use of atomic weapons was set at Hiroshima. They are weapons of aggression, of surprise, and of terror. If they are ever used again, it may well be by the thousands, or perhaps by the tens of thousands. Their method of delivery may well be different, and may reflect new possibilities of interception and new efforts to outwit them. And the strategy of their use may well be different than it was against an essentially defeated enemy. But it is a weapon for aggressors, and the elements of surprise and of terror are as intrinsic to it as are the fissionable nuclei.
You've been listening to the actual words of J. Robert Oppenheimer, spoken in November 1945 at a meeting of the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia on the subject of nuclear weapons. The bomb that he helped create had just been dropped on two cities in Japan, causing the deaths of well over 200,000 people. Oppenheimer was beginning to have second thoughts about the future of the atomic bomb, and those misgivings would soon be his undoing. That's the subject of John Herron's conversation this week with the authors of American Prometheus, this year's winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award for Biography.
For his work on the atomic bomb, physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer was heralded as an American hero and patriot in 1945. But less than a decade later, accused of weak character and communist sympathies, he was publicly humiliated by the same federal government he had long served. And as our guests this week illustrate, such a rapid rise and fall is but one part of the complex biography of one of America's most noted scientists. First is Kai Bird, author of The Color of the Truth, McGeorge Bundy and William Bundy, Brothers in Arms. His co-author is Martin Sherwin, the Walter S. Dixon Professor of English and American History at Tufts University and the author of the prize-winning A World Destroyed, Hiroshima and Its Legacies. Their latest book is American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, published in 2005. By Alfred Knopf. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Well, Kai, let me start with you. I think we often assume that individuals of great achievement have lived a charm existence, that their greatness was apparent literally from birth. But that's not exactly Oppenheimer's life, is it?
Oh, no, not at all. He had a very complicated and nuanced life. He was somewhat of a child prodigy. He was born in New York, raised in the ethical culture school, but he was a painfully shy young man and had a very prolonged adolescence. In fact, as a young graduate student in Cambridge, England, he suffered a near nervous breakdown and saw not one but a series of psychiatrists. And he was a man who had to repeatedly transform himself. When he initially began teaching, he was a lousy lecturer. He couldn't be understood by his students. But he was able to learn how to be a good teacher. And this repeatedly happened throughout his life. He rose to the occasion and yet had difficult crises in which there were instances in which he would sort of freeze up, in which he failed at what he attempted to do.
Well, Marty, one of the interesting elements within this story then has got to be from that beginning into his transformation to a very charismatic figure.
Absolutely. And that's one of the intriguing things about Robert Oppenheimer. He grew out of his painful, youthful social incompetence. At the time that he was in Cambridge, England, he even contemplated suicide. And what transformed him was his ambition, his innate intellectual ability, and his commitment to trying to be at the center of things, and that also became his Achilles heel at the end of the story.
By the time America enters World War II, then, there is little debate that once shy, now very accomplished Oppenheimer was an exceptional scientist. I mean, he was clearly a rising star on the American scientific scene. But still, why him? Why was a theoretical physicist chosen to direct this most important project at Los Alamos, a project perhaps better suited to a more practical scientist or even an engineer?
Well, Robert Oppenheimer was not only a very charismatic man individually, but he was a polymath. He was a scientist. He was on the cutting edge, as you've just explained, of quantum physics in the 1920s. But he also loved French literature and poetry, and he was a beautiful speaker. But he was the kind of man who could speak about physics to laymen and explain it in plain English. And so when Leslie Groves, the general in charge of the Manhattan Project, came out to Berkeley to interview a number of physicists who he hoped would work on the atomic bomb project, he was introduced to Oppenheimer, and they clicked immediately.
I just want to add one thing, that if I was asked to identify Oppenheimer's most important intellectual characteristic, it would be his ability to get to the center of an issue quickly and clearly. And that's what Groves saw in Oppenheimer. and that he didn't see in Lawrence and all of the other people who were the candidates for this job.
Right.
Oppenheimer was able to understand what had to be done to create this bomb as quickly as possible.
Right. Well, at Los Alamos then, I mean, Oppenheimer was extraordinarily successful, as you both just suggested, in first organizing and then later sort of motivating his fellow scientists. And clearly, part of their collective drive was the belief that they were in a race to beat the Germans to the bomb. Did you discover that our understanding of the German bomb program has changed at all? I mean, were they indeed close to building nuclear weapons?
I can answer that quickly. The answer is no. It turned out when the Alsos team, the intelligence team, went in right behind the Normandy invasion and discovered where the Germans were, they were quite surprised to find out that they hadn't even got to what you might call square one, which was the Fermi experiment in the squash courts in Chicago, showing that nuclear fission was controllable.
Did the scientists at Los Alamos have any sense that that was the case?
In fact, Grove kept that information from them. It was discovered about December of 1944, and the last thing he wanted to do was get that information back to Los Alamos and find that the scientists said, well, okay, we were here to race against the Germans, and the Germans didn't even get off the starting block, so we shouldn't build this terrible weapon.
For all of the scientists involved in the project, including Oppenheimer, the successful atomic test in the New Mexico desert, July 1945, was marked by great celebration. Everything had gone so very well. Yet quickly, Oppenheimer began to voice doubts about the bomb. Is that correct?
Well, it is true that in the 2 weeks after the first test, the Trinity test, and just before the actual use of the bomb on Hiroshima, Oppenheimer was a conflicted soul. He was in meetings with people in the military, instructing them exactly how they should drop the bomb, at what altitude to have the most impact. And at the same time, we tell a story that we heard from his secretary, who lives here in Washington and is still alive, Ann Wilson Marks, who recounted that one day she was walking to work with Oppie in Los Alamos, and suddenly he began muttering, "Those poor little people, those poor little people." And they discussed it, and he was referring, of course, to the Japanese civilians who were about to be wiped out in a whole city by one bomb. And, of course, after Hiroshima, within days, he plunged into a deep depression. And we can see this in the letters that he wrote to his closest friends and from the account of his wife, Kitty.
Right. Marty, you mentioned that one of his strengths as a scientist was his ability to get to the center of the issue. Would that be the same in this case? I mean, did he immediately recognize the long-term implications of the bomb on humanity?
Yes, but it didn't take the genius that Oppenheimer was to recognize these things. There were many people, actually maybe many geniuses, among the scientists who recognized it. And after the war, that was the scientists' issue, how to turn the administration towards a policy of what they called the international control of atomic energy.
Well, beyond their qualms or beyond their doubts that the scientists possessed, was there also a sense that they had, in fact, created this project or created the bomb, but now in the post-war, even perhaps even before the bombs were used against Japan, that they were losing some control over their own product, or in fact that they were maybe being deceived by the government in any way?
Well, Oppenheimer felt betrayed in a certain sense in the immediate post-war period. He had been told that the bomb was necessary to end the war against Japan. Yet, very soon thereafter, in September, he came to Washington and he realized, talking to Henry Stimson, the War Department secretary, and others, that Japan had been very close to surrendering. And Oppenheimer gave a speech a few weeks later saying that this bomb had been used on a virtually already defeated enemy. So he thought that he had been manipulated, and this was a warning to him, and he tried very hard in 1946, 47, 48 to convey to President Harry Truman that this was not like any other weapon and that there had to be controls over it and that it was a threat to America.
John Kai mentioned one of the reasons, and another is that the invasion wasn't going to be until November 1st. The other reason was that the Soviets had committed to enter the war no later than August 15th, and originally 3 months after the surrender of Germany, which was May 8th, and that means August 8th was 3 months later. That's in fact when they came in. And it was clear to everyone that when the Soviets entered the war, the Japanese would surrender. The other thing was that unconditional surrender was, as the emperor wrote, the only barrier to peace. And Oppenheimer learned that the Japanese had been, in fact, trying to surrender for a month and a half on terms other than unconditional surrender. So he was appalled within a couple of months after Hiroshima about what had been kept from him.
Well, his increasing outspokenness grabbed the attention of everyone, as you mentioned, from Harry Truman to J. Edgar Hoover to the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, Louis Strauss. Yet it's not going to be necessarily his position on nuclear weapons that's going to precipitate the ultimate public crisis as much as it was his political activities of nearly two decades earlier. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, but that was largely the excuse. The excuse was his left-wing associations, his associations with the Communist Party in California and Berkeley, the fact that his wife had once been a member of the Communist Party, the fact that his brother Frank had been a member of the party, and that a number of his students had been party members, and that Oppenheimer had himself contributed money to causes like the Spanish Civil War that were sponsored by the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
So they used those associations, and the allegation that he himself might have been a party member and subject to party discipline as an excuse to go after him and to question his loyalty to the country. But in fact, the real motivation for the growing sort of conspiracy to bring down Oppenheimer was motivated by his opposition to the building of the hydrogen bomb and his skepticism of the whole defense posture that the United States was moving towards in relying completely on this weapon as the centerpiece of its national defense.
Right. Well, given that controversy or given that setting, in many ways, the heart of your narrative is not Oppenheimer's work on the bomb, but rather a Star Chamber-style hearing in 1954 that led to the revoking of Oppenheimer's security clearance. What was the final outcome of that hearing?
The final outcome was that he was found loyal to the United States, but nevertheless a security risk. And that outcome was reached in, as you said, a Star Chamber-type hearing in which all kinds of illegal violations of government policy with respect to the hearings and proper judicial procedures were violated in a relationship between Louis Strauss, chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, and J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI. In fact, this was so outrageous that when Kai and I put it all together, we actually brought this to a law firm in Washington and said, isn't there a case here to have this hearing nullified? And Arnold and Porter, the law firm, Dean Acheson's old law firm, has agreed to do that. And they are taking up this case and looking into the incredible violations. I mean, Kai will list some of the things that were done.
Well, among other things, Louis Strauss, the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, had J. Edgar Hoover wiretap Oppenheimer's private home, his office, and the office of his lawyer, so that the conversations between Oppenheimer and his lawyer during the course of the security hearing were taped, and every day a transcript was given to the prosecutor, Roger Robb. It's a direct, gross violation of his civil liberties.
With a lot of resonance today,
right,
by the way.
Yeah. Well, even given that sort of extra legality of the hearing itself, you both point to the fact that in the wake of that hearing, even more significant was this sea change in attitudes about science in America. How did the Oppenheimer case transform the social landscape of science and politics in post-war America?
Well, there was a saying that came after the case that scientists should be on tap and not on top. And it was the culmination of a struggle in our political culture between the crude orientation towards the Cold War that was represented by, let's say, Louis Strauss, and a far more complex, nuanced, and sophisticated orientation towards dealing with the Soviet Union and nuclear weapons that was represented by Oppenheimer.
Well, thank you both for joining us. I hope we can talk again soon. You have been listening to Kai Bird and Martin Sherwin, authors of American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, published by Alfred Knopf. This is Talking History.
Welcome back. Following up on our discussion of J. Robert Oppenheimer, Fiona Beatty joins us to tell us about a museum where you can learn more about the history of the atomic age.
Located in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the National Atomic Museum, soon to relocate and be renamed the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History, provides both the in-person and virtual visitor a comprehensive exploration of the progression of the atomic age. Exploring its beginnings with Marie Curie and the discovery of radiation to modern nuclear medicine, the museum encourages visitors to examine nuclear science from both its peaceful and destructive applications. Virtual visitors should click on historical perspectives in the left column for explanatory text and photographs from 21 sections that begin with waging peace and end with delivery systems. And as historians are fond of pointing out, nothing is new. Arms control, waging peace, has been around for quite some time. Among the several instances cited, at the cusp between the Bronze and Iron Ages in 1100 BCE, the Philistines restricted the use of iron by the Israelites. The section, The Dawn of Modern Arms Control, includes a reproduction of John Singer Sargent's famous World War I painting, Gassed, of soldiers exposed to mustard gas being treated at a field dressing station. Accompanying text describes the many international legislative moves to create rules of war, such as the Geneva Convention. For those interested in the Manhattan Project, the site provides photographs of director Leslie Groves, Robert Oppenheimer, and Los Alamos, plus links, texts, and more. When the museum moves to its new location, exhibits will include aircraft and rockets designed to deliver nuclear systems. For more information, go to atomicmuseum.com.
And finally, Stephen Usden concludes our show with his thoughts on what motivates those who resort to treason, terrorism, or even suicide bombing in pursuit of a cause or in an attempt to topple a nation. Usden, senior editor at BioCentury Publications, is the author of Engineering Communism, How Two Americans Spied for Stalin and Founded the Soviet Silicon Valley.
The September 11 attacks, as well as the London and Madrid bombings, were planned and led by men who lived in the West, by fanatics who sought to overturn political and social order, even destroy society, in the name of an all-encompassing ideology. Comprehending the motivations of such fanatic ideologues, especially those who have lived among us, is critical to disrupting and preventing terrorism. 50 years ago, headlines were also dominated by accounts of treason, real and imaginary, but at that time the focus was on zealots who idealized Stalin. Although their goals and methods cannot simply be equated, there are commonalities between Americans who spied for Stalin and those who today dedicate their lives to the nightmares preached by radical imams. Communist spies hid behind a facade of legitimate political expression. Recruiters of 21st century terror co-opt religion. Several members of Julius Rosenberg's espionage ring have explained their conversion to communism, providing us with insights into the roots of ideological fanaticism. They were children of the Depression, poor, living in a self-contained ghetto, and largely ignorant of mainstream American culture and values. The fantasy version of Soviet life portrayed in propaganda films seemed as plausible to them as the Daily Worker's assertions that the U.S. was run by a gang of greedy plutocrats intent on exploiting the workers. Some may question whether Julius Rosenberg and his comrades were fanatics. Rosenberg and his comrades crossed from the left edge of the political spectrum to being ideological fanatics the day the Nazi-Soviet pact was announced. For Jewish intellectuals acutely aware of Hitler's anti-Semitism, remaining in the Communist Party required blind, religious faith. My research suggests that they spied not to help an ally, or even to fight fascism, but because they were Soviet patriots. Rosenberg's espionage career began before the Nazi invasion of Russia, that is, while Stalin was aligned with and providing assistance to Hitler. Rosenberg's formative experiences bear striking resemblances to condition in Parisian suburbs today. The high-rise housing projects are reminiscent of New York tenements. Like Rosenberg, Muslim immigrants throughout Europe feel the sting of racial and religious discrimination. Some are attracted to the utopian siren song of Islamic fundamentalism. Noting the similarities between Rosenberg's Confederates and European jihadists is not intended to suggest a moral equivalence. Nonetheless, comprehending how fanaticism's roots lie in alienation from society and a desire to advance an ideological fantasy is relevant to understanding and fighting 21st century terrorism.
You've been listening to Stephen Usden, senior editor at BioCentury Publications and the author of Engineering Communism, How Two Americans Spied for Stalin and Founded the Soviet Silicon Valley. Usden's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. That's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.